The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Football League Times. West Brom extend their lead. Leeds keeper does a mini ankle one, but they get a point at Brentford, while Forest make changes and slip up against Charlton. In the Premier League, Hakim Ziyech signs for Chelsea and John Moss is allegedly incredibly rude to Dan Gosling. Archie is in, so we'll do a big Germany roundup as Klinsmann's had enough in Berlin, and we'll try and work out where Jadon Sancho might be playing next season. There's a Premier League preview and we make some important Star Trek-based corrections. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, already laughing at the Star Trek-based corrections. We'll get into them later.
The Trekkies are a body of people you don't want to upset.
No, and you did upset them.
I think I know what I did wrong.
Yes. George Ellick, nice to see you.
Nice to see you too.
From Not the Top 20 podcast, are you well?
Yeah, I am well. I'm still kind of reeling after hearing what Barry had for breakfast, but Barry, I'd say it again.
Well, so. Tell us what you had for breakfast, Barry.
I had 2 raw eggs in a glass of milk.
It's utterly repellent behaviour, isn't it? It's like Rocky. Why don't you look like Rocky?
I'm taller than Sylvester Stallone.
Are you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess that's a win.
A lot taller.
It's a win of sorts, I guess, isn't it? Is that on your Tinder profile? Also in the studio, covered in doner meat, Archie Rintutt. Nice to see you.
Hello.
Are you well?
I am.
Excellent news. Right. Should we start then with the Football League? We'll start with Brentford 1, Leeds 1. George, you were there.
I was.
Weren't you? How did you find it?
I thought Leeds were very impressive. It might go against the narrative that everyone wants to hear that Leeds are slipping up again. But the return of Calvin Phillips, who served a 3-match suspension, completely changed them. Because it was interesting to see that the game against Nottingham Forest on the weekend that people may have seen on TV, they lost that game 2-0. And normally when Leeds lose games of football under Marcelo Bielsa, they dominate the game, they don't put their chances away, and they concede the one or two chances they let go. Whereas against Forest, they were the worst team. They had no control of the ball. Sabri Lamouchi's Forest dominated the game and were good value for their win. So coming into this game against Brentford, a team who are also challenging for promotion, a team who on their day are probably, alongside Leeds, the best team in the Championship, although I'm sure West Brom fans will have something to say about that. But they came into this one with a performance drop that we haven't really seen necessarily before from a Bielsa side, and they dominated this match. They were the better team from start to finish. They only had Kiko Kassia to thank for the goal they let in. As you say, it was a bit of an Enkelman moment. A back pass slipped under his foot, and Saeed Benrahma scored the easiest goal he'll probably score in his career.
It was brilliant fun, that.
It was brilliant fun. I mean, if you're a Leeds fan and you've got a keeper in Kiko who was brought in last year to replace Bailey Peacock-Farrell, who made similar gaffes, although none under his foot, normally just parrying balls into the back of the net. It's frustrating they've now got a keeper in Kiko Kassia who came with such high pedigree, who is consistently making mistakes pretty much every game. I mean, Sami Amiobi's goal for Forest, he was beaten at his near post. He's made plenty of them so far this season.
That away end as well, to make that mistake in front of that away end where you can hear every single word at Griffin Park of what the away fans are saying. I was shuddering just thinking at the prospect of doing that. It's, oh.
But that's exactly it. And you've got two guys at each end of the pitch who are much maligned and probably for the right reasons. You've got Kiko, who's throwing the ball in the back of the net every game. You've got Patrick Bamford, who, for all of his industry and his good work and his ability to get into good goal-scoring positions, I mean, he's developing into what we used to think of Edinson Cavani as that player who just misses good chance after good chance.
I was going to say Cameron Jerome, but I'd probably prefer Cavani.
I think Bamford's better than Jerome. I think we can say that. So it's impossible for this Leeds side to function effectively, even if they are playing this brilliant brand of football, even if they do dominate games when you've got two such crucial positions, players in those positions who aren't performing. But as I said at the top of the answer, Calvin Phillips is a player who is destined for very, very big things. And I'm someone who's maybe thought in the past that Leeds fans overplay his quality. But in the 3 games that he missed and seeing his return on Tuesday night, his energy in midfield, his ball-playing ability, he's someone who is going to be so important to Leeds going forward. And so long as he's fit and in that side, I think we're going to see the Leeds of earlier this season return.
Still, it's 10 points from a possible 33 for Leeds. You know, in the form table for the last 10 games, they are 21st.
Mm.
From what you're saying there, they You know, you're saying they turned a corner. The first question was from Patrick saying, when is the right time for Leeds to change the manager to not risk staying in the Championship again? I saw
Sam Allardyce. I assume that must be tongue in cheek, I think.
I mean, I saw Sam Allardyce, you know, people saying, well, you know, get Sam in to finish the job.
Is there
look at you shake your head.
I don't even want to dignify that with an answer. I mean, this what's easy to forget about this Leeds side because Leeds is. I mean, I don't want to use the word big club, but Leeds is a side in a club that you assume their rightful place isn't in the Championship. And if it is, it's towards the top end. But budget-wise, this Leeds side, you know, the squad hasn't been built with a massive budget at all. It's not one of the biggest wage bills in the league. He's taken a squad of players that was largely underperforming before he came in and improved them player by player immensely. So I think that anyone who's thinking that Bielsa is the problem here is just completely missing the point. I mean, he is the reason why they're there. He is the reason why that coming second in mid-February or early February is a bad thing for the club. Anyone who's questioning his merits to be in the hot seat at that club needs to have a rethink.
I was going to say, if you look at the Championship top six and the amount of teams that are there without parachute payments, Leeds being one of them, Leeds have not been in the Premier League since 2004. And what Bielsa has done has been incredible. We being Fulham, were lucky.
I like how you said Fulham. Like they said it on Championship Manager 2. Yeah. Fulham.
I've noticed that, well, in Germany, I have to change the pronunciation sometimes to get understood.
Okay. And you're boring some shopkeeper about Fulham.
Yes.
Okay.
For example, the game against them, a very fortunate penalty decision probably gave us the win in that. But Leeds have been sensational. And I agree with George. I can't see any other manager who would come in now and also command the respect that Bielsa does, because I think his reputation of what he's done at these previous places as well, at Marseille and at Athletic in Spain, is really quite something.
As a fan of Fulham... How do you feel about Brentford? You know, this sort of romantic story now that Brentford could leave Griffin Park and have their first season in the new stadium in the Premier League.
As an away fan, I will miss the ground,
right,
which I probably shouldn't say.
Okay,
but I know that it's giving a lot of Fulham fans the heebie-jeebies, the prospect of playing Brentford in the playoffs, because of how comprehensive a performance they gave in the 1-0 win back in December. It was, if it had been a bout, then it would have been over probably before half time. George is smiling here, which is unnerving me even more. but yeah, Brentford are really good. Brentford are a very good team with not, I would say, standout individuals who come together. Whereas Fulham are a team with lots of standout individuals in the squad who are not a very good team. It's almost the opposite of when Fulham went up 2 years ago and were battling against Cardiff and we were playing well almost every week and yet still not quite getting into the top two. Whereas this season, it's much more resembles what Cardiff did in that we're grinding out results and yet not playing very well.
I don't know if you saw the other day, but Pontus Janssen said in an interview that around March last year, while playing for Leeds, he was just physically tired, but emotionally and mentally drained. Do you think Bielsa will do anything different this time around to try and prevent this happening from his players? Caveat, Pontus Janssen had also just had his first child with his partners, which may have contributed.
I think there's some thinking around Leeds that Pontus Janssen may have been part of the problem at the back end of last season. It sounds like Marcelo Bielsa had decided, I think probably more on a personal level than a footballing level, I think he had decided that come the end of the season it was time for Janssen to move on. So I'd take that with a bit of a pinch of salt, especially knowing that he has now left the club and is probably putting the pressure on a promotion rival. Because last season, despite the fact that Leeds did absolutely fall short, and it was that game against Wigan where they were 1-0 up at home against 10 men, against the Wigan side battling relegation and managed to lose it 2-1, and then went on to that ridiculous game against Derby where, you know, they'd basically qualified for the final and then in the second half of the second leg just completely capitulated. So unlike previous Bielsa seasons where you see in Europe where there is a gradual descent into just a horror show, last season it was effectively just 90 minutes in the league and then a half of football in the playoffs.
And I guess once there's this narrative that people, you know, a team is tired, every time they don't win or they don't do something, like, it's true that
Helder Costa had a shot in the second half, which he just sort of dribbled.
It was awful.
It did look like he was really knackered, yeah. But then he'd been running around. He might have just been knackered, I guess.
For me, when the performance levels drop, that is the time to be concerned. And that's why the Forest game was a bit of a red flag, because we hadn't really seen that from Bielsa's Leeds before this season or last season. So in a way, that's why I think that, whilst I'm not saying that Leeds are by any stretch going to definitely finish in the top two, I think the manner of their performance, going to Brentford, a side high on confidence, a side playing very well, basically dominating every single aspect of that game, is probably the most significant performance this midweek, because you had Brentford fans at 1-0 up singing Leeds are falling apart again. From what I saw, from the evidence I saw, that's just not going to be the case.
It wasn't the live game in the UK. For some reason, they put the Swansea QPR game on, which was absolutely disastrous. But you could watch it on the red button. And the great thing about that is the red button doesn't get like the HD treatment. So it is a bit like watching and there's just one camera flowing about a bit behind the play. So it was like watching a goals video from about 1987. I found it really, really fun. But West Brom then are 6 points clear. They won 2-1 at Reading. Kyle Bartley had a fun night. He did one of those why am I punching the ball in the penalty area handballs to give away a penalty early on, then scored the winner with a back post header just after half time. The league doesn't lie, George. Are they the best team in the division? Comfortably so?
I think consistently so, yes. I mean, they've obviously come out of the back of one of their own poor runs of form, but they've backed it up with 3 wins on the trot. And They rode their luck against Reading at times. That they were dominant until they went 2-1 up, and then Reading in the second half had plenty of chances to come back into it. But the really impressive performance was at Millwall on Sunday, where they won the game 2-0. Every single one of their outfield players had a shot, including their subs, which just shows you the level of dominance over a Millwall side.
Makes it sound like they all lined up like one by one.
But Millwall had 7 shots and all 7 were taken by Jed Wallace. So that shows you the contrast in the two performances. And that, you know, Millwall under Gary Rowett, as Archie can attest to, is a difficult place to go. They press very high there. They don't let you play. And it was that horrible weather on Sunday as well. Not the easiest one. And they dominated that match. So I think West Brom have come out of their slump. And in Slaven Bilic, they've got a manager who, you know, one West Brom fan tweeted the podcast the other day comparing him to a Championship Jurgen Klopp. I'm not sure that West Ham fans would necessarily agree with that, but it shows you compared to last season where they got to the playoff semi-finals with a caretaker manager in Jimmy Shan, the level that they've stepped up to this season. They've got a player, Matias Pereira, who I think is probably the player of the season so far in the Championship, as an attacking midfield player. They have so much quality throughout that team as well, and now they're through their run of games where they got a little bit lonely out in front. I'm pretty sure we're going to see them kick on now. And it looks, with a gap between first and second, it looks like it's a clutch of clubs beneath them playing out for that second automatic spot.
One of which is Fulham, and they went to Millwall. Tough place to go, as you said, doing one under Gary Rowett. You were there, Archie.
I was.
Did you have a nice time?
Well, as the song goes, you'll have a nice day at Millwall. And it was an enjoyable evening, yeah. Albeit the football wasn't part of that necessarily. The first half was torrid. Millwall, as George suggests, pressed very high. Fulham played a series of long balls, which didn't connect. There was a really bad refereeing decision to give Millwall their goal, where
John Daddy Bodvarsson, which is a brilliant name, by the way. He was about 3 yards offside, wasn't he?
Yes. He was quite far offside. Yeah. But as a fan, can I say that Fulham merited anything from the game? No. It was really poor, and I would say symbolic of the way that Fulham have been playing overall, pretty disjointed, lots of big names, the likes of Anthony Knockaert, Alexander Mitrovic, who has been playing very well. Marek Rodak is not a name, I would say, that is particularly big before this season. He started the season as second-choice goalkeeper, but he's been probably, alongside Mitrovic, the player of the season in goal. He has won Fulham points. He is the first goalkeeper the club has had since Mark Schwarzer, who you would say, this guy's responsible come the end of the season for where we are in the table, because he's picking up, I would say, 10 points a season. But I would say, as a fan, I have overall concerns about the direction that the club is still going. I remember, as part of the Fulham Supporters Trust, being in a meeting where, at the end of last season, we put the question to the club, what lessons can be learned from the last Premier League season, where so badly did it go that now doing a Fulham is in the footballing vernacular. I see it every week, kind of, or Aston Villa doing a Fulham, and it's just like, it makes you as a fan go, like, oh, no.
It's nice to it's nice to be talked about.
At least
right?
You're not doing a Leeds. <I'd say>.
True.
Or a Sunderland.
But, yeah. but the club, to that question, said that they didn't, it, like, what happened last season didn't mean that there were lessons to be learned from the approach.
Right.
Which just made you put your head in your hands and think, how can you not take any responsibility? And I think that's the frustration, is that there is that culture I see within the club of, well, it's not my job or whatever. We saw it with the ticketing prices last season in the Premier League. You ask people, oh, well, you know, that's to do with something else. And you see how much money is being poured into the club. There was a great piece by Miguel Delaney that I'm sure quite a few people have read. And it just kind of plays into that, really. I just think it's just sad. It's so sad that people can't see the reality. And, okay, we have a very rich chairman who... Like, it's great that the money's been put into the new Riverside stand that we're going to have from the start of the 2021 season. And of course, we're grateful for that. But like, the reason I enjoyed the Millwall game last night was because I was there with my mates.
Yeah.
Because I was able to be back. It's like,
but I mean, that is what football is for most fans, right? Of most clubs. Most clubs aren't winning and most clubs aren't doing well, right?
But in a way, I don't really want to get promoted because I quite enjoy the Championship. And I know that if we go up, we're going to face the same problems as you see that Burnley, Bournemouth have. Just how do you make fun of it after kind of 4 or 5 years of hanging about?
Well, you could do a Fulham.
Right.
have Fulham changed their recruitment policies? Is the owner's son still in charge?
Yep. Tony Khan is still in charge. He now has Javier Pereira, who was on Slavisa Jokanovic's coaching staff, by his side, which is good because I don't think a lot of fans were convinced with the fact that Tony was also doing his wrestling entertainment company at the same time, alongside other projects. And it settles things down a little bit, but I'm just not convinced. Fulham really need to go up, in, if not this season, by next season, because obviously their parachute payments, you only get it for 2 years if you go up and then come straight back down. So they're under pressure. That's why that a lot has been invested in the likes of these players who have come in. But for Fulham, have to play West Brom away, Leeds away, Brentford at home, Forest away still. So those are four of the top five.
And a few big games. Results recently. I mean, Jed Wallace missed a penalty.
He hit it
yesterday.
To orbit. Did it hit the top of the bar?
James Collins took exactly the same penalty for Luton about 10 minutes before, which was bizarre, hitting the top of the bar and going over the stand behind.
It nearly hit me.
But that was...
that would have been fun.
Were you in the car park? I didn't realise. but there's... So, I mean, that was a fairly... Not a lucky getaway, but, you know, you've faced a team who missed a penalty. I was at the Huddersfield game where, despite Fulham being 3-0 up after half an hour, Fulham were lucky to get 3 points that day because Rodak made a string of saves in the second half that kept Huddersfield out. So, I mean, I think Scott Parker deserves some credit for turning around Fulham's form in the last 2 months or so. But as a fan, having seen someone who I hold in very high regard in Slavica Jokanovic get promotion out of this league, how would you rank and how would you rate Scott Parker as a novice manager?
Jokanovic was doing much more with much less. And I think Parker has had to pick up the pieces, you're right. And also, let's not forget either, after that Brentford defeat, the fans were pretty much calling for his head. There was a lot of pressure for him, and that was only December, and then a good run of form came. So I think Scott Parker has it. I've seen some criticism that he's not ballsy enough with some of his substitutions because we've not won a game in the last 10 minutes. But I mean,
that's every fan base in the whole country.
Right. You know, throw more at it. And you're like, well, I mean, 11 of our last 12 wins have been by a single goal, which says how tense it's been. But in a lot of the cases, we've been going into the last 10 minutes, hanging on to a lead and have kept it. So I'm interested to see where we're going with that, particularly because there's been talk of, are Fulham going to be the next West Brom in terms of sacking Darren Moore, treating Parker the same way if Fulham were to start dropping points and dropping out of the playoffs, such as the pressure on promotion. So let's see.
Now, you're at Millwall on Wednesday and Hamilton on Tuesday.
Exactly.
I like the thought of how many people are also in that Venn diagram for you. Could you
specifically Hamilton the musical, not Hamilton the Scottish football club.
There weren't many.
Which was better, Hamilton or Millwall 1, Fulham 1?
Hamilton.
Yeah.
It was, yeah.
I suspect you don't get as many jazz hands at the den.
A ticket for Millwall is hopefully a lot less.
Definitely yeah. Some hand movements as well at Millwall. So.
I was going to say, the Millwall fans were giving quite a few hand movements if you look to the left of the away end. So, yeah.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll round up the rest of the Championship, do the Football League, do a bit of Fit Bar 2.
Today in Focus is the daily news podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anushka Astana, every weekday as I bring you stories from across the UK and around the world. We'll take you to the front line of the climate emergency.
The smoke smells like everything is on fire.
Behind the scenes in Westminster.
We're in the sort of political Wild West.
And we'll cover the latest trends in technology and popular culture.
TikTok, TikTok, buzz, buzz, buzz.
Go on, subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Are you having fun, Barry? Are you having fun?
Yeah.
Great. Live shows we've got. Glasgow, Barry. We still haven't sold all the tickets because of William Shatner.
Right. Okay. Well, okay. Come on, people of Glasgow.
Sort yourself out. Me, Lars, Philippe and Barry. Edinburgh sold out. Me, Lars, Ellis and Barry. We're doing Earth in Hackney on the 23rd of March. And we're back in Leeds on the 9th of April. Back to the Football League. Nottingham Forest, after beating Leeds 2-0, lost at home to Charlton. George, rested a lot of players, but 5 players? Mm. Didn't turn out to be the right call, I guess. Is that complacency? Because this game was sandwiched between Leeds and West Brom, right? You can kind of understand.
You can understand it. It's one of those where it looks pretty silly now. But Sabri Lamouchi deserves credit for that win against Leeds. And he obviously decided it was a fit game to shuffle the pack. And you can see why Charlton have been in rotten form now for about 3 months. And Tyler Walker was one of those changes who... son of Dez, was on loan. He had a successful loan spell last season in League Two. Was very good at Lincoln in League One this season. Was recalled in January, came off the bench to score the second goal against Leeds. So you can understand why he would bring him into the side. So yeah, as I say, it's certainly one of those. It doesn't look great now, but I think at the time most Forest fans understood why he did it. But it just continues what's quite a weird statistical trend about sides who beat Leeds, where Leeds have lost 8 games this season in the league. 7 of those sides have gone on to lose the next game. Fulham, the only one who didn't, and they drew. So no side has beaten Leeds and gone on to win the next game.
So it's sort of Leeds have this kind of tire, you know, they're tired, but the tiredness serum rubs off onto the team that beat them, and then they're too tired for the next game.
Well, the frustrating thing is, it's a really good stat, but then when we tweeted it off the podcast account, we had loads of Leeds fans telling us it was because every team treats it like a cup final, which is probably the most tiresome thing you can hear in football. But either way, there's probably something to it. I mean, we don't want to talk about Leeds too much again, but we know how they play and the effects that it obviously has to face a side who play with such high intensity obviously affects the way that they play the next game.
Preston are up to 6th, 2 pretty scrappy goals in their 2-0 win at Stoke. They're still in the mix. How much of a surprise is that?
It is a bit of a surprise. I think it's testament to Alex Neil and the job that he's doing there that they are still there. Again, they're another side who certainly don't have the resources to be punching as above their weight as they are. It was a fairly fortunate 2-0 win against Stoke. Stoke had by far and away the better of the chances. And it was a bit of a smash and grab. But it does feel like that 6th spot in the Championship is very, very much up for grabs with Preston and even Bristol City struggling to really impress too much on a consistent basis. So that's a big win for them.
3 points between 2nd and 7th right now.
It's tight.
It is tight.
Preston have a left back called Ben Davis. And for a second, Barry, I thought, that's one of those transfers that I've totally missed. Ben Davis gone to Preston, but it's a different one. He's English and he's taller. And speaking of Stoke, Barry, you tweeted your praise of a absolutely glorious montage of Roy Delap. Long throws.
It was brilliant. The effectiveness of the Delap long throw as a weapon, it's worth seeking out. Someone has put together this montage of just assorted defences failing hopelessly to deal with what should be, you would think, a fairly straightforward ball to deal with, but it really wasn't.
No, with the I Need a Hero music, which is just so good.
I like these slightly obscure compilations. Mm. Like, someone did one of Fulham midfielder Stefan Johansson's various acts of shithousery, of just him, like, fouling people.
Oh, it was marvellous, wasn't
beautiful.
It? Bristol City, you mentioned them, George. They beat Derby 3-2. Naki Wells got his first for the club. City were 3 up before Derby got 2 late goals. The real highlight of this game was Ashley Williams doing some great acting, where he clearly handled it in the box and then pretended he had a really painful head, that the ball had hit him in the head. Bristol City level on points with Preston, one place outside the playoffs. Obviously, there's been a lot about Wayne Rooney being at Derby. He seems to be doing pretty well there.
I think he's basically been the key reason for their upturn in form. They're a side who've struggled to control games in the way that Philippe Cocu wants to, you know, a manager who's come in with a certain continental style. And if you think the player that Rooney is replacing is Tom Huddleston, it probably shows you just that level of control they're getting with Rooney. And he's still, you know, he's not going to be a player who can get around the park particularly well, but he's got a player in Dwayne Holmes who is basically a Duracell bunny who just runs around Rooney doing all the running for him. And his quality on the ball, his vision from deeper areas, he's basically playing as a quarterback. And he's doing it successfully. So he's definitely. I doubted how much of an impact he would have there, but he's come into Derby and immediately been their most important player. And he's enabled other flair players like Tom Lawrence to just have less pressure on them and less onus on them to do all the legwork and concentrate on being effective in the final third. So the Rooney experiment so far has been successful, but that was a big defeat for them against Bristol City, because if they could win that one, the playoffs were in sight. Whereas after the result last night, that looks unlikely.
Luton beat Sheffield Wednesday 1-0. Huge win for them. Takes them off the bottom of the table. They're still 7 points from safety. They missed a penalty. Pretty much an open goal as well, but finally got their goal through James Collins. On Sheffield Wednesday, the Guardian understands that the club have complained to South Yorkshire Police and Crime Commissioner about the policing at their matches, which they're concerned can be too heavy-handed. It follows an incident that you might have seen on social media, caught on camera, of a police officer striking a 16-year-old boy over the head with a baton after the game at Barnsley last week. The club haven't commented publicly yet. South Yorkshire Police initially said they would carry out a full open investigation into the incident, then announced that they were referring it to the Independent Office for Police Conduct. Back on the pitch, Wigan 2, Middlesbrough 2. Brilliant own goal by Harold McCoody. Diving header. Huddersfield 0, Cardiff 3. Josh Murphy with a nice dink. The second was a great volley from Will Volks and one from Callum Patterson. This, an interesting result for both those sides, George.
Yeah, well, Cardiff under Neil Harris are going from strength to strength, and they are sitting now in eighth, just I think it's 4 points off the playoffs, which not many saw coming a few weeks ago. And this resounding victory certainly has their fans dreaming of a quick return to the Premier League. And for Huddersfield, every time we think that Huddersfield and Stoke get the result that's going to push them away from the relegation zone, they seem to lose next time. And given Charlton's victory over Forest, it's now Huddersfield in 20th and Stoke on 21st, who sit 5 and 4 points above Wigan in 22nd. And Wigan and Luton are both kind of showing signs of life at the moment. So anyone who thought that the relegation battle was over, especially Huddersfield and Stoke fans, might be slightly concerned.
Blackburn beat Hull 3-0. Adam Armstrong scored an absolute belter for Blackburn's second. Go and find it. Barnsley are bottom. They lost 1-0 at home to Birmingham, and Swansea 0, QPR 0 was the TV game. It was so unbelievably boring. In League One, as it stands, Rotherham are top, 56 points from 30. Peterborough have played a couple more, have 55. Coventry, 54 from 29 games, with Wickham, Sunderland and Pompey below them. Did anyone expect Rotherham to be up there?
Probably. They always seem to be there. It's just kind of yo-yoing between League One and the Championship. So, yeah, if I'm going off a blind look at the league.
Your blind League One taste test.
I would say, Rotherham will be there or thereabouts come the end of the season.
The remaining Chuckle Brother, I'm sure, expected them to be there.
That's true.
And Howard Webb.
What about you, George?
There or thereabouts is probably right. I mean, it's worth looking back to September, where Paul Warne was coming under a bit of pressure from Rotherham fans. He even changed the dugouts at the New York Stadium in a bid to improve their home form, which seemingly worked.
From what to what?
Just swap them around.
Really?
So that he was closer to one half of the pitch, because he thought that was, you know, where if they're, I think, attacking the second half that way, he wanted to be on that side.
Okay.
But anyone who doesn't know about Paul Warne should definitely...
He's interesting. Enlightened guy,
really,
isn't he?
Interesting. Like, I did a radio thing with Richard Wood about 18 months ago, who's their captain, And he was telling me stories about how he gets the players together every so often, all in the same room. And he gets them to go up on a stage and tell the squads and tell the other players and the playing staff something that's an issue in their life at the current time, whether it's a family relative who's unwell, whether it's issues with their kids or whatever. And he feels like having that emotional connection to your teammates is something that can really play out on the pitch, where if they're not just your mates who you see for 2 or 3 hours every day, if they're someone who you care about and you understand what they're going through, that's going to make you work much harder for each other. And despite the fact he oversaw a relegation last season in what wasn't a level playing field whatsoever, he's on the brink now of getting Rotherham promoted for the second time in 2 seasons from League One. And they're not one of the sides, despite the relegation, they're not one of the sides with a lot of star quality in their side either. So if you're looking at the EFL, I would say that Paul Warne is someone who, he was a reluctant manager to start with, but he is consistently doing things a little bit differently and consistently getting results.
Before the pod, Barry stood up in front of all of us, and the issue in his life, he's got nothing to cook eggs with, and so he has to drink them raw. And now I feel that we're bonding more than we ever have, Barry.
I've never hated you more, man.
What's Phil Parkinson done at Sunderland? Because, you know, there was a time he arrived and basically managed to get them knocked out of what every possible...
He knocked them out of... three cups in
very,
his...
Very first... shrewd, that, I think, isn't it?
Hmm?
Getting knocked out of the cup.
Well, it probably was. I mean, George was telling me something interesting before the pod, that, you know, shortly before the revival in fortunes started, you know, the main Sunderland fanzines and podcasts and fan groups had all sort of united in issuing this statement saying they wanted him gone and the owner of Sunderland gone, and... they're doing really well now. He has turned things around. And George was saying that they canvassed opinion among Sunderland fans to say, you know, do you regret doing that? Do you think you were mistaken in calling for his head? And they all said no.
We weren't mistaken. We're looking forward to seeing what he can do now, was basically the line. But we, you know, Oxford played Sunderland. I'm an Oxford fan. We played Sunderland in the EFL Cup and won on penalties. We went on to play Man City. We had a big cup run in the FA Cup, which saw us play Newcastle twice. It's been brilliant. But you now look at the table, and Sunderland are fifth and Oxford are 10th, and our form has completely deteriorated off the back of the cup run. So there probably is something in the fact that Parkinson, you know, that tricky first spell where, I'm not saying he did it deliberately, but getting knocked out of those cups is probably the best thing for an EFL side, given the fixture congestion. And in terms of what he's done, I think he's got rid of some players who were underperforming and apparently weren't particularly good influences behind the scenes.
Aidan McGeady.
Yeah, Aidan McGeady and Mark McNulty being two of those. He's got a really good core of a side in Luke O'Nine, in Jordan Willis, in Lyndon Gooch. And these guys are all kind of 24, 25 years old, players on the way up. And that hasn't always been the case at Sunderland. It hasn't been the case at Sunderland for a long time. I'm not entirely sure that signing Carl Lafferty on a short-term deal aligns with that recruitment strategy at all. But it does now feel like they're a side whose trajectory are moving forwards rather than relying on players who are dropping down a level and still earning extraordinary money.
And is anyone else in the mix in the playoff, below the playoffs? What's this, Doncaster, Fleetwood and Ipswich there, Archie?
Ipswich.
Right.
I'm sure we all have friends who you look out for their team a little bit more when you're going down the results on a Saturday. Ipswich are one of them. And as a result, I've been having my ear bashed about what has been going wrong there. And they've not scored from open play in 5 games.
Brilliant.
And this is a team that, I mean, you would expect them to get promoted. I think it's fair to say they gave Paul Lambert a 5-year deal recently.
In the middle of a terrible run of form as well.
Right. And like, I know they've been struggling since Kane Vincent Young's been out in October. But you look at them, it's one of those clubs that you look at in fifth, Sunderland sixth, Portsmouth seventh, Ipswich, one of those clubs where you fear for them if they don't go up. I know Portsmouth have bounced back from League Two and whatnot. And I have to say, my friend's been less than charitable over the text about Barry.
Well, he's probably one of the many Ipswich fans who had a go at me for the manner in which they treated Mick McCarthy. But they don't mind being in League One because they're playing free-flowing Brazil-style football. So, you know, they don't care what division they're in as long as the football's brilliant.
His view is that McCarthy should have gone 18 months or so before he did, but also that the problem is not necessarily the manager. The problem is more with the structure. The fact that everything was too much. I think Mick McCarthy is of a certain generation where you can control everything and he's able to oversee all those things at the club. The problem with someone like Paul Hurst is that there was almost too much for Paul Hurst to take on and too much for him to change because the club's been in a steady decline. It's not about Mick McCarthy. It's about the likes of Roy Keane and Paul Jewell before that as well.
Oh, no, that's true because they were punching above their weight with Mick McCarthy. They were a League One side in the Championship.
No, completely.
And now they're a League One side in League One.
And I think it goes
and
to
I
Marcus.
I think it's hilarious.
which fans are more dangerous to upset, the Ipswich fans or the Star Trek fans?
Oh, Star Trek.
Yeah, absolutely. The bottom's pretty odd because, you know, with Barry obviously going out of business. Are you showing the text about Barry to George?
You can read it.
Come on, read
it
to all of us. Share it with the whole class.
Please do.
I'd like to say that I really get on well with Barry, okay. First of all. But
you're just the messenger here.
Yeah, go on.
If McCarthy's mate Glenn Denning is on, then he's a massive bell end with an axe to grind because of the way Mick left, by the way. You may have your own view on him, and I do have my own view on Barry, but you won't find a fan who would even now take Mick back. He was talking so much utter shite about it with no idea about the club.
Yeah, fine. It's grand. He's entitled to his wrong opinion.
I mean, if any Ipswich fans out there wouldn't want Mick back now, you know, the football's already pretty terrible and you're not winning games, so...
I think his point was that the football was already terrible for a long time Mick. And I think there's just a frustration of... They've been in the Championship for how many years
you look at this Ipswich squad and there's this idea that they are underperforming at the moment, probably based on the fact they started the season so well, but their squad isn't very good.
In League 2 on the pitch, Swindon are top, Crewe and Exeter in the automatic places. Plymouth, Colchester, Northampton and Cheltenham make up the playoff spots at the moment. Stevenage are 7 points adrift from Macclesfield at the bottom, only one going down to the conference. Cambridge is the big story, George. We sacked Colin Calderwood and since then have won 3 on the bounce.
Huge.
It's a huge surprise, frankly.
Yeah, and it sees you. Are you top half of the table now? I think you are, which didn't seem likely coming.
I feared that we might totally drop, actually.
Well, I think that's what I wanted to kind of warn against is we see it happen a lot where a manager is sacked, which costs money in itself, and you promote the assistant manager or caretaker manager into the full-time job or just to the caretaker role, win a couple of games, and naturally owners are going to think to themselves, brilliant, well, we've got our ready-made replacement here. This happens a lot, and normally it lasts for about 6 months before you realise actually there's a reason why this person wasn't an AFL manager previously, and experience is quite important, and actually having an idea of how to manage is also quite key. Football's a game with massively high variance, and the fact is that after long runs of poor results, wins normally follow up quite soon afterwards. So I would just be a bit careful if I was a Cambridge fan before saying that Mark Bonner is the man to lead you forward into the playoffs.
Okay, noted. I will make my decision forthwith. Fifth bar, Barry. No chill, Phil says. Is Steven Gerrard allergic to league titles?
Oh, that's brutal, but a fair question, I think. I think the jig is up for Rangers now, or what passed for the jig. They got beaten by Kilmarnock, going down to a late winner from Eamon Brophy, having surrendered a one-goal lead. And while they were losing against Kilmarnock, Celtic thrashed Hearts 5-0. Hearts were lucky to get nil and lucky not to concede a lot more than 5. I saw extended highlights of that game and Hearts were one of the worst football teams I've ever seen. They were staggeringly bad. I mean, absolutely awful. And you knew as soon as the first goal went in, they knew that they looked a beaten docket. Rangers, disappointing defeat for them. They were goal up. Alfredo Morales headed over from a few yards out when unmarked in the penalty area. You'd have expected him to score. And then he had a goal disallowed for one of the officials spotted a shove in the build-up. And after the game, Stevie said, we looked all over the place. We couldn't handle a simple long ball. We've got some issues at the moment, but I'm responsible for them. I put this group together. I coach them. They are my tactics and decisions. So I'm not going to sit here and try and force any blame in any other direction than myself. And then he said, our leaders in the team couldn't clear our box. So, it's a done deal. Celtic are, they're 10 points clear of Rangers, who have, Rangers have a game in hand, but Rangers don't seem to have the character. Since the winter break, they've dropped a lot of points. And Hearts, the abject Hearts, they are 1 point... they're at the bottom of the table, 1 point behind Hamilton, the musical, which Archie attended last night. And they play Hamilton, the musical, this weekend. So that's a big, big game at the bottom of the table.
It really was good. But
yeah. Oh, no, I've seen it. It's...
Well, Hearts weren't.
You're right. It is really good, isn't it? The Alfredo Morelos mistranslated interview saga rumbles on. Celtic are refusing to cooperate with Sky. After that incident, they've been unhappy with Sky's response and apology, which they felt lacked a satisfactory explanation. They have reported the situation to Ofcom. Coincidentally, this week, a 12-year-old has been charged in relation to alleged racist chants directed at Morelos during the Old Firm derby on the 29th of December. Rangers have given a statement relating to this incident, criticising the media's role, saying, Rangers had a duty of care not to say anything that might compromise a live Police Scotland investigation. What none of us should ever do, however, is dismiss or trivialise abusive behaviour, as too many media outlets, journalists and pundits have done in this instance. When a player is at the centre of an abuse claim, he is treated with respect and sensitivity and given support. That is certainly the case in England, but not here, and most certainly not with Alfredo Morelos, who's actually being demonised in many quarters of the media. Referee news in the Premier League. John Moss, Bournemouth contacted the Premier League regarding the alleged conduct of John Moss during their 2-1 defeat at Sheffield United. Dan Gosling accused Moss of having zero respect. He said, I thought he was a disgrace. The comments he made, especially to me and one other player, talking about the relegation zone and you're still in the relegation zone and you're having one, your team's having one, this and that. It was very, very disrespectful. I thought it was very disrespectful what he was saying. Bournemouth made the Premier League aware of its grievances, requested they investigate the microphone recordings of Moss during the game. The Premier League will not be taking any action against Moss. He will remain in contention for officiating Bournemouth games in the future. I mean, you do hope he's put on Bournemouth's next game. My first reaction is to sort of laugh at Dan Gosling being a bit precious. But even when I've been playing games at my terrible level of football and I've had the odd referee going, well, you're not having a good game. At that exact moment, as a player, you are incandescent with rage, and you
because he's right.
Well, he may well be right, probably because he's right, but also because the referee shouldn't be doing that. Like you,
but you abuse referees. You've told me that Bournemouth players abuse referees. So for them to, you know, get the fit of the vapors when a referee has a go back at them, a mild go by the sound of things. It's very hypocritical.
But they are meant to be impartial referees, aren't they? I mean,
you could be impartial and still joke with players.
Yeah.
Is it not possible to think that both are wrong? Because this is what I mean. I think that it's ridiculous how flagrantly referees just ignore the rules against them being abused themselves. I mean, we see it on TV every single game. You're meant to show them a yellow card if they swear at you. It happens 20 times, and that is if this shines a light on that and the way it seems to be doing, that's only going to be a good thing. But at the same time, Moss shouldn't be doing that. Like, you shouldn't, if you've got two sets of players who are competing, you know, who are not going to have a cool head, who are going to be emotional, and then you've got the guy in the middle who's meant to be impartial, who's meant to be calming down everything, and you've got him telling the team that they're not playing very well.
It's not
tit for tat. They're both wrong. I mean, neither of them should be doing it. And I think that, I wonder with this case, because Gosling spoke about it in the media, that's why we know about it. I mean, it might happen the whole time for all we know.
I disagree. I think he should be giving it back. I think it's a good thing that John Moss is responding, because he is a human. And there is only so much, I think, that you can take, particularly because could Dan Gosling stand with his hand on his heart and say that, you know, he's treated referees with the same respect throughout his whole career?
I'm amazed no one's made a 2-minute compilation of Dan Gosling abusing refs.
Oh, completely.
But maybe he's the nicest footballer.
But the correct reaction is to book them. Do what you're meant to do. Don't, you know, he can't. If Gosling is being abusive or swearing at the referee, so show him a yellow card. He can't come out in the press afterwards and say, you know, that was a disgrace. He didn't show me any respect. To reply being like, you're having one, mate. Like, come on. It's just... It's not.
But what would Dan Gosling actually prefer? A yellow card or to be told he's not playing very well?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'd like to find out. I'm sure it would probably be told he's not playing very well, but give him the option.
I think this will come back, or it could come back to bite Bournemouth, because if you're a referee doing a Bournemouth game now and you're sort of, there's a 50-50 or someone's, you get a bit of yap from one of their players, you're going to take the yellow card out, or you're going to be inclined not to give them a 50-50 decision because Dan Gosling's a little grass.
It has also shone a light on the good comebacks you've had from referees over the years. I've enjoyed these stories coming out now. So,
yeah, you do see the Welsh rugby referee,
Nigel Owens.
He often has a go at players, and it's often quite funny. You know, I remember him criticising a hooker for not throwing the ball in straight. And he said, oh, I can't remember the hooker's name, but he said, oh, come on, I'm straighter than that. And all the players are just laughing. But
storming a teacup territory. I think George is probably right. I don't think refs should be doing that. But
also, all the people out there, not saying you, Barry, but all the people saying, like, look at the abuse that players give referees. I'd like those same people, when they're abusing their players at a game, the player turned around to them and said it back to them. I'd like to see their reaction. Well,
absolutely right. Whenever a player has a go back at the crowd, that is, you know, as Barry always says, that is swooning Victorian ladies, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, let's just hope they both have a cup of tea and become great friends. And then they could do like a BBC Two documentary when they go fishing together, that kind of thing. John Moss and Dan Gosling.
You're best mates with John Moss, aren't you? So how does he strike you as a bloke?
He struck me as an extraordinarily lovely man.
Right.
And interesting.
Did you go to his record shop?
I didn't, but he told me about it. We were in Hong Kong, and he said he'd been around Hong Kong to find vintage Chinese vinyl, which was not what I was expecting him to have done with his day off.
Maybe you're the guy to bring this documentary together.
Absolutely. Bringing Gosling and Moss together. Gosling and Moss. A Gosling in the Moss. As I say it to my dictaphone. Right, Wolves-Leicester's on Friday. Should be a fun one, that. On Saturday, it's the winter break, isn't it? So there's only six fixtures. Southampton-Burnley is the early kickoff, and Norwich-Liverpool, the 5:30 game. Reverse of the opening day fixtures, these. Liverpool won that 4-1. I can remember us all going, oh, Norwich will be absolutely fine, that they played really exciting open football, and they'll be fun and they'll be fine. Villa play Spurs on Sunday at 2 o'clock. The FA have written to Dele Alli for his observations about the video in which he appeared to mock an Asian man and claimed he might be infected with the coronavirus. This is the first step in a process which could end in a charge of misconduct. On Monday night, Chelsea play Manchester United. Chelsea have agreed a €40 million deal in principle to sign Hakim Ziyech from Ajax. 26, been at Ajax since 2016. Has got 6 goals and 13 assists in his 18 games in the Eredivisie this season. 48 goals and 82 assists in 160 games overall at Ajax. Chelsea apparently tried to get him in January. Ajax didn't want to sell him mid-season. It'll mean that Pedro will leave on a free this summer. Willian's place looks to be uncertain too. His contract also runs out. He's apparently unhappy with the one-year deal on offer. This Arch is I think what a player he is. And actually, €40 million is not that much for Hakim Ziyech.
Yeah, have you seen that video on Twitter of him hitting that crossfield ball?
Oh, I tweeted it out. Oh, it's such a great... It is a wonderful pass, isn't it? I mean, if I had €40 million, I wouldn't pay just for that, but I'm excited to see how well he does. I think it's a really clever signing.
Yeah, he's a star and has been threatening to be one for a while, even when he was at FC Twente as well. And you look at the options that gives Chelsea, along with Christian Pulisic, and a potential incoming of Jadon Sancho. That's a frightening lot of attacking midfielders that they've got themselves there. So, yeah, I think a very good signing for Chelsea. The Fulham fan in me is always disappointed when seeing such players move to the dark forces, but, you know, it's a very good sign.
Do you think that's where Sancho will go?
We'll have to find out in part three.
All right, yeah. Well trailed ahead. That's it for part two, and we'll be back in a moment. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Just a heads up, now we're going to talk to Archie about where you've been for the last couple of months and have a discussion around mental health issues, including depression. we understand that these issues could be difficult for some people to hear. We feel it might be useful, though, to discuss the issue, hear about Archie's experiences. Lots of people, you know, have tweeted you and me and all of us sort of saying, where's Archie in his kebab shop and where's he been? And you wrote a really long Twitter thread explaining it all, but not everyone listening is on social media. So
sure.
Where have you been?
I had to take a break because I had depression. It started really over the summer, but it had been there for a while before. And it was exceptionally tough. I was in a very dark place come September, and there was a morning when I was meant to work for Fox, and I woke up and the night before I tried going for a run just to try and break out of it, but my body had just shut down. I think that's been one of the biggest learnings of it, has been that just what it does to your body. You think it's just a mental thing, but physically I was kaput, as the Germans say. I was just completely gone. I had a burnout back in March that I thought I'd come back from, and I had to be taking stuff very slowly. But it was when I was kind of broken down on the side of the road, and I didn't even really have the energy to cry, which is something that I'd not really experienced before. And that was really tough. But I have to say that Fox have been superb with me. You guys have been exceptional as well, as have the Bundesliga World Feed, in terms of giving me the space to recover, which is huge. I've had people get in touch saying, I wish I had that, and other people saying, I'm being given that space by their employers. And to be told that it's okay, you come back when you need to, you take your time. It's not everything, because everyone recovers at different rates, but that has been huge, because it gives you the feeling that you really do have that space that you need to recover.
How vulnerable do you feel telling people that you're having mental health issues?
It's something that it happened a few years ago that I first realized that I had it. And from there, I've just kind of grown in confidence of saying, I have this, because I think it makes the elephant in the room smaller. And it's important to do that as well, because it reduces the taboo of it. And that's partly why I posted the thread I did on Twitter as well, because I had been away for a while. And I thought, if I can help maybe one or two people in a small way by showing that this happens to people in every walk of life, because it does. If Gigi Buffon and Andres Iniesta can have it and both be World Cup winners, then it can really happen to anyone.
Are you comparing yourself as a footballer to those two?
I am not, but it was something that in my mind I was just looking at one day, and I was just like, you know what, I think that shows it.
Sure. What were the first steps in getting the help you needed?
Stopping everything, taking a break, and going and seeking therapy, which is something that I resisted for a while, thinking I can do this myself. And then you realize that actually getting another set of eyes on things is really beneficial. But also having family and friends giving me the necessary space. And I think that there can sometimes be this thing that people want to help by trying to be positive the whole time, but actually allowing people to come to their own conclusions and make their own steps forward. And it can be a case that you just need to kind of shape the mirrors in the way of the person so that they can come to their own conclusions. Mm. Because I think you feel most empowered when you're able to make your own realizations, not letting someone else make them for you. So that was important. But I think just space. For me, I'm happy to say that I'm on antidepressants, and that has really worked well for me. That took a while, but I think particularly being that I'm 27 and I've grown up in a generation where everything is at your fingers like that. And so the recovery process, and like I've been someone who would just usually go back to work within a week and just be like bang on it, and that's not the case here. Like it is weeks, it is months, and taking that sort of
time when you're just having day after day where it is dark, it is really dark, is really difficult. But that's where, for me, because I'd worked through basically ever since I left school and uni, I was fortunate enough to have like the savings to go traveling. And that helped open it up, because I would, like, back home, as much as I love my family and my friends, the questions were, when you're going back to work and how's the depression going? Yeah. And that can
And actually, like, that's really important, I think, because, and everyone is different, but, like, what would your advice to people who are trying to help people who are going through it? Because your instant reaction is to say, how are you today? Mm-hmm. But I don't know if that is the right question, right?
Sure. I think that is a... It's an authentic, it's an honest question, and I think that's fine.
Yeah.
And I think it's just trying to give people that space so that they feel comfortable. However you can make them feel comfortable, whatever you think's going to make them feel comfortable to open up, or to just be how they need to be right now. But also, I guess, just being aware that what kind of state are they in. But, you know, I guess it just relies on how well do you know the person in front of you, and, like, how can I make them feel comfortable? I think people can maybe be afraid of saying the wrong thing, but you know what? As soon as I think anyone in that position is aware that you're at least just trying to, that it immediately helps bring the guard down. At least it did with me.
What did you tell your employers, and how did they react to it?
I said that I had depression, and my employers here, Football Weekly, Fox and Bundesliga World Feed, were all unanimous in saying, take your time, come back when you need to. And that was a big relief, I think, particularly as a freelancer,
yeah,
where you are kind of in a constant churn and you're worrying, where is the next gig going to come from sometimes?
And did that worry you particularly? Like, the freelance world is, however you are feeling, is a pretty precarious thing, right? And how do you navigate that?
Yeah, it can be, because you're always, I mean, particularly in this, I mean, that's part of the trade-off is you're working weekends, and then it, because everyone else is working during the week, you always think, oh, but I need to fill that up as well. And that's kind of, that's the danger of it. And then when you have nothing, like, everything felt quite bare. But to be honest, I was just dealing with something altogether bigger than that, that it was like, it just kind of went to the back of my mind in the end.
And what worked for you? I mean, obviously, what works for you doesn't necessarily work for everybody, sure. But what did you find work for you?
Traveling was huge, and that was a big risk as well. Like, I literally looked up where were there cheap flights to, which were far away from here, because I just needed some space from everything. And that happened to be Colombia.
Great place.
It's a really great place. But for me, that enabled me to meet lots of people who were actually in a similar position, who were experiencing, who had experienced mental health issues themselves. And, you know, it's like with anything, some people you get along with, some people you don't. And the people that you click with and you have conversations with, I mean, there's just certain words and certain things that people said to me and that I heard that made me kind of view things in a different way. And I think just having that sort of fresh eyes and ears on a situation, but particularly face to face, like, as much and as great as Twitter is sometimes, I think using that for me is something of a trigger, because it just accelerates my mind. And that can be almost dangerous in a sense. So just having that sort of social contact face to face with people in a very low pressure environment was, yeah, invaluable.
If I can ask, I have no experience of suffering from depression, so I've struggled to, I think, realize just how bad it can be. Is it something that hits you like a ton of bricks just overnight, or does it creep up on you? And if you can describe it or feel able to, what's going on in your head when you're in this dark place you speak of?
It can feel like a creep. It creeps up on you sometimes because you're wanting to fight it. I mean, in my personal view, I was trying to fight against it and not bow to it. But everyday situations can just trigger it. Like, for me, I was talking about some dark experiences that I had at school on holiday with my friends. And I was already on holiday with my friends in July and was not feeling good. And I was like, I have all my friends around me. I have jobs that I absolutely love and I feel awful. There's just a kind of a darkness that kind of, it works like a cloud. Like, it's just a very big storm that kind of passes overhead. And it's difficult to describe because it just kind of takes over and it just shapes your thoughts in such a way that it puts a kind of a downer on literally everything. And then you can't function. I remember just lying down at home on a day in September and I was just like, I can't get up. I don't want to get up. I don't want to do anything. I don't want to see anything. And it was difficult. That night, I managed to push myself out and my friends helped me push myself out to Fulham against Wigan, which helped a bit. but I mean, even then, like, I think just having that human contact again, like, I'll never forget that I walked into the row because I took my dad's ticket that night and there was a guy who, without knowing anything of the situation, goes to me, "So what's keeping you alive then?" And I was like, "Well, not much actually right now."
what did it take for you to, you know, get from there to consider that you were well enough to come back to work?
So firstly, I just had to leave football alone for a while, which was really, really tough. And, you know, you still check scores in that, but I'd lost all motivation. Mm-hmm. It was just gone. And I think it was as the motivation for football came back in December and it hit hard. Like, you know, if there had been copies of Match and Shoot magazine, like I was when I was a kid, I would have been buying them because suddenly it just went into overdrive again. And I think that's when I started to feel like physically healthier as well. Like, I'd had a huge, not to go into kind of into doctor's detail, but I just had like a huge mucus, like just sitting in the back of my throat that would not budge for months. Mm-hmm. 4 months. I played football in the summer and nearly collapsed, which was already a sign telling me that my body is not right. But I was like, no, it's me needing to come back. So when I started to feel physically better, that was the point where I was like, okay, like physical and mental is starting to marry up here. And just also there's certain breakthroughs that you make in your head as well. So it was around mid-December, I thought, with another month and a half or so, like, I think this could work. So that was when I
came. How good did it feel to hack up that grolly? It must have been sensational after months there.
To hack up the what?
The mucus.
Oh my God, amazing. Like, yeah, it was a lot as well.
And how are you now?
Good, still a little bit there. Doing better, yeah, better, I think is the key word.
I think there's, you know, for people listening, I mean, certainly for me listening to you, there's like an immense bravery that comes about this whole process, whether it's admitting to yourself there's an issue, whether it's admitting to your family and your friends as an issue, and also just you talking about it now. So for anyone who's listening who maybe is trying to find that bravery to do something about it, knowing that there's something wrong, I mean, what kind of advice would you give to them in that process?
Like, hang in there, first of all, because the storm does pass. Like, as much as I was like, when is this going to happen? Like, there were many days thinking, when is that going to happen? But it does pass and it is worth it, but it is long. And also, like, to be honest, as like, a few of my friends have said to me now, to be honest, the real journey starts now in terms of trying to recreate a routine and get back to some form of normality. And I appreciate that, but I think there are rewards if you look for the small things. Like, that's the basis of it. I can heartily recommend Matt Haig's books, Reasons to Stay Alive and Notes on a Nervous Planet. Those really helped me. They might not help you, but I can say that it certainly shone a light
on what I was feeling and how it was feeling and made me not feel like I was alone.
So, what, yeah. What was the Fulham Wigan score?
2-0.
All right.
2-0. Yeah, right. It was still not one of our good performances this season to return to an early
Look, thanks so much for being so open, Archie. As George said, I think, you know, if it helps one person, right, that's doing a job, isn't it? And we are very pleased that you are coming through and you are getting better. And look, if hearing this conversation has been useful to anybody listening, it will have been worth it. And if you have any thoughts or feel like you need to talk to anyone about any of the issues we've just discussed, there are a great many resources available. Among them is the organisation called Mind, which has a partnership with the Football League. They're responsible for the little squiggle at the start of names on the back of the shirts. If you're in the UK, mind.org.uk has a lot of helpful information. Their number is 0300 123 3933. If you need to talk to someone, please do. All right. Now, actually, let's get you to do some actual work. Jurgen Klinsmann resigned, right? Amazing stat from Richard Jolly. Jurgen Klinsmann spent on average about £900,000 a day in the transfer market during his time in charge of Hertha Berlin.
Hertha
Berlin. I should know that. I supported them. I went to watch them when I lived there for 6 months when Brian Roy was up front for Hertha. What happened there?
It's a mess. And Hertha have been trying with good PR for a while now. They've had the investment of Lars Windhorst come in during the summer. As you can see with this copy of Elf Freunde that I have here, the German football magazine, that has brought the bling to them. It says a company of the Windhorst group there with some... I don't know how you describe that, but it's
like a medal, right?
Medallion.
It's a medallion, yeah.
90s bling.
Yeah.
It's like something someone from Run DMC would wear around the neck.
That's perfect.
And like Hertha have had this influx of money that we saw with the likes of Christoph Piontek being signed in January, and Klinsmann was at the heart of that. The problem for Klinsmann is that he didn't have enough control and thought he was going to wield that sort of control. And when it became apparent to him that he wasn't, and that Michel Preetz, who is the manager there, as we say in Germany, more of a sporting director role, the structure was always going to stay. And Klinsmann thought he was going to be able to override that. He wasn't able to. And now, with his reputation already, as one fellow journalist put it to me, something of being clown-like, it's not... been improved at all. And Hertha, for example, I remember they had a slogan which was, "We try, we fail, we win." And it just kind of made you look at, like, it was on the side of the pitch for the, and you're just like,
doesn't go, doesn't work, does it?
No. I mean, there's quite a few of these things in Germany that the things that they say that they think, yes, like that'll work in English because it sounds cool to German ears. But yeah, Hertha is, it's a mess, and it has really put the club in quite some trouble. I think they'll still stay up, but they've got a big away game away at Paderborn this coming weekend. And for Hertha as well, there's all this talk that Lars Windhorst had talked about them being a big city club. He wanted them to be on a level with the likes of PSG and Chelsea, but you have to have it right on the football side. And that's what this whole PR bluff of Hertha has always ignored. And the irony is that they talk about wanting to be this kind of cool club. The truth is that there is a cool club in Berlin, but it's not Hertha. Yeah. And it's because they stick to their values. And that's, of course, Union. And it's just a very frustrating experience. They play in a half-empty stadium the whole time, like in the Olympiastadion. They need to have their own stadium, really, which has been planned to come through at some point, but it's a mess.
He said in the fight against relegation, unity, solidarity and concentration are the key elements. If they're not guaranteed, then I cannot deliver as my full potential as a coach and cannot live up to my responsibility. But yeah, as we said, backed in the transfer market, the league's biggest spenders in January, biggest spenders in the top five leagues across Europe. They spent £68.5 million, 39% of all the money spent by the top flight clubs in Germany.
He also just threw out basically a lot of players who had been good, solid performers for Hertha over the last few seasons. Salomon Kalou, for example, just left to find a new club. Even looked like Arne Meyer, who is a name that you might be hearing in a few years' time as well. Midfielder, who's up-and-coming German talent. he was mooting that he might want to find a new club as well. And these are players that you want to be taking on board. I mean, Kalou less so, but he's an important figure still for that side. So just the way that he managed it, Andy Kupka came in as a goalkeeping coach, which did not rub well with the current goalkeepers at the club. There was something to do with the fact that Zolt Petri, who's the goalkeeping coach, has now been reinstated there, and that there was something going on with him and Jonathan Klinsmann, who is of course Jürgen Klinsmann's son, who was at the club for the last 2 years as a third choice goalkeeper. So problems afoot there, and a complete misjudgment, I think, on Klinsmann's part of how things work now. He had a go at how German football was being run, that he wasn't used to this kind of model. He was used to more of an English model, but what does he expect?
He's remaining on the board there, though, because he has quite a long connection with the club, doesn't he?
That now looks like he will not be on the board any longer.
Jadon Sancho, where's he going
to
be?
If he goes to Manchester United, I don't think that's particularly wise. I think that
Chelsea also, I mean,
Chelsea is a more likely destination. Mm-hmm. He's a smart kid.
Don't
as
City
well.
Still retain the first option as well?
Yeah. I think this hurts. Chelsea would probably be the best club for him.
But would the Premier League be the best place for him, or
he can play anywhere.
Right.
He can really play anywhere. He is one of those players that when you see him play live, it is a joy, because he can make something happen at any point in the game, and it is that cage footballer ability that he has about him. The fact that he can, I think that you look at players sometimes, particularly now in the modern game, and if they see a kind of a line of four people ahead of them, they're like, okay, pass, pass, pass. Sancho is like, right, I'm back in the zone here. I can dribble past how many of them now? And it's so great to watch. It's great to almost watch the fans as well at those points, because you see others kind of having this excitement about him as well. So, look, I think that he could get to the ability that Eden Hazard reached at Chelsea, such as his ability to beat players in one-on-one situations. But as you say, if he wants to go to Real Madrid, if he wants to go to Barcelona, I think, to be honest, why limit yourself necessarily just to the Premier League? Not.
Schalke have been fined €50,000 as a punishment for their fans racially abusing Hertha Berlin's Jordan Torunariga. They're doing something interesting with it. €16,000 will be spent on workshops to tackle discrimination, which will come out of the fine. So instead of paying the DFB, they'll be directly funding a solution to the problem. Sounds like a good thing.
Sounds like a good thing, right? Which is exactly what Schalke would like right now. Schalke is a fantastic club with great tradition, but as you can probably tell by my tone, it has been overshadowed by what Clemens Tönnies, the chairman, did at the start of the season, when he said, when talking at a conference, instead of increasing trees, we should rather finance 20 power plants in Africa every year than Africans would stop cutting down trees and producing children when it's dark.
Oh my God.
Which
wow.
is... And he did not resign. He did not resign for that in August. He was suspended 3 months after the board looked at it. And you just think, how on earth does he survive that? And it's so such a short time ago that you wonder, did the fact that Tönnies was kept on empower this one supporter? That's the shame of it. It's because this does not represent Schalke. And yet you have a chairman there who has stayed on because his financial input at the club has been great before, yes. But it's just such a shame, because it's cases like this that mean that we will still be talking about racist incidents in the future, hopefully with not that much regularity, but it's just, yeah, it's sad.
Thanks, Archie. On the John Moss being slightly rude to Dan Gosling, a slightly stronger story in Italy. An Italian referee's been banned from football for a year after he headbutted a goalkeeper. it's taking it one step further, isn't it?
What do the keepers say?
that's the point, isn't it? Antonio Martinello sent off Borgo Mogliano keeper Matteo Cicchioli during their match against Montotone. Cicchioli went to the referee's dressing room afterwards seeking an explanation. They began to fight in a corridor. The ref headbutted him, sending him to hospital for treatment. This is one way to do it, I suppose. Bournemouth players, watch out next time John Moss is refereeing. Finally, Barry, Star Trek. Ben writes, I love Barry making a very nerdy, pedantic point about Doctor versus Mr. Spock, and then going on to say that Scotty was played by Colm Meaney. Tony Cowards, the comedian and writer, says Colm Meaney played engineer O'Brien in The Next Generation. Canadian James Doohan, who was injured during the D-Day landings, played Scotty on the original show. Stop getting Star Trek wrong.
Oh, I can only apologise. I'm sorry. Sorry to all those Trekkies out there.
All right. Well, I hope that apology is enough.
It's quite unlike them to pick up on mistakes that anyone might make.
Anyway, look, that'll do for today. Barry, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
George, thank you.
Thank you.
Archie, thanks so much for speaking so openly, and thanks for coming.
Thank you.
No worries. We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.